Officially called to order. Steve, you confirmed that we have a quorum.
We do have a quorum and we...
John Fallon joining.
And John Fallon just joined.
Welcome, John. We're just getting started.
Sorry about being a few minutes late. I apologize.
That's no problem. Why don't we just go again around the room quickly for the people on the call so that they know who's sitting at the table. And again, speaking, this is Michael Castellana.
Vince Stelio, President's Office.
You need to speak up too because the things are over here.
Peter Walls, FQ.
Christine Bouchard, Student Success.
Steve Bettitz, Finance and Business.
Pierre Ulrich.
Susan Phillips, Provost and Vice President.
Janet Thayer, Associate University Counsel.
John Riley, in the Office of General Counsel.
Robert Jones, President.
Can we have a motion to approve the minutes of July 17th?
So moved.
Pierre, is there a second? Somebody?
I'll second.
Thanks. Those would be accepted without exception. President Jones, floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon to everyone here in the conference room and also on the phone. I certainly hope that everyone had a enjoyable summer. Seems like only yesterday we were at graduation. I'm not sure where the summer went, but it went rather quickly as far as I'm concerned. But we are very, very happy to have started the fall semester. It's off to a good start here. Started on Monday. And the campus is really abuzz with a lot of activity. Had the pleasure to go over today to participate in a food tasting venue at lunchtime where we had faculty and staff provided them an opportunity to sample some of the food from our new food service providers, Sodexo, and some of the food providers that they brought to campus. And so if the samples are any indication, we're going to have some excellent places to eat. I just hope things don't change over time. But I'm fairly confident that the students are going to be very excited and hopefully satisfied with the food because we tried to address and earn their concerns with locally grown foods. We had a lot of demand from types of food that they're used to having back home in Brooklyn or wherever they might hail from. So we did as much as we could. I think Sodexo has been wonderful in that regard, and we look forward to having a long-standing relationship with them. So we are pleased to welcome this week the class of 2017. There are 2,550 students who enrolled as incoming freshmen this year. Which was from over 21,500 applications. And so we're very, very pleased the fact that there remains a very strong interest in undergraduate students in enrolling at UAlbany, and we expect to see this number to grow over time. The high school grade average was about 90.1, which is up slightly from the 89.7 from last year. The average ACT score is about the same, about 1141. There are 200 of these new freshmen or presidential and Frederick Douglass scholars. And so we have a lot of young people that are really highly regarded in terms of the academic credentials that are part of the freshman class. And diversity has increased substantially. 41.9%, up about 3 percentage points from last year. So overall, I think we have a strong freshman class with good credentials that represent students from all social economic classes, and so we're very, very pleased with that. Overall, our student enrollment this year is 17,740 students, which is up slightly from where we were this year, last year, with there was about 12,887 undergraduate students, and this year we have 13,147. We're seeing a 8.2% increase in the number of out-state undergraduate students, and about a 19.9% increase in international students, all of which we're very, very pleased with, and it's a good start, and we plan to do more. We plan to bring in more out-state students at the undergraduate level as well as continue to grow our international student profile. Because I think you all know that historically about 92% of our students at the undergraduate level have been from the state of New York. While that's wonderful,
to be able to support the citizens we know with the changing demographics, that's not sustainable. And so we're very, very excited to see that these, some of these things that will become or are part of our metrics and benchmarking process, that these arrows are moving in the right direction. We also started several new living and learning communities in biology, chemistry, East Asian studies, and in history. We continue to grow our faculty, as according to our NY SUNY 2020 plan, there are some 55 new faculty that have joined the campus this fall term. And I think, Sue, you would agree that we have hires across each and every school and college at this university. And so we're very, very pleased with the progress we've made in tracking and taking advantage of our NY SUNY 2020 investments to grow the faculty at this university. And so we're definitely on track there. I think you all know that we opened the new School of Business building last week. We had a very lively celebration with a very large number of regional leaders, members of the legislature, friends of the university, who joined us on campus for the ribbon-cutting ceremony. If you haven't had a chance to visit this building, make sure you do so. Let that be your first stop the next time you're on campus, and I think you will be very, very pleased and surprised at this wonderful new hub of learning and innovation here at the University of Albany that we believe will further provide an opportunity for this business school to become nationally recognized. It's already ranked number 86 out of over 450 some odd schools and businesses, and we have put a stake in the ground that it will be one of the top 50 ones in the next 5 years. And I think with this facility and its ability to attract some of the best students, and we certainly hope to attract some of the best faculty in the next 5 years, that we will certainly reach that goal. There's still a lot of construction going on campus and other projects that will be coming to completion here. The new football stadium, of course, which is nearly complete. I had the pleasure of touring the facility last Friday and was very, very impressed with the scope of that project, the quality of the workmanship, and I can tell you it is a significant improvement over what we've had heretofore. Somebody said, well, anything would have been better than that, but I won't go far as saying that, but I am very, very proud of it, and I think all of you should be as well. I think it's fitting and proper that we come into a new stadium as we enter the Colonial Athletic Association this year for the first time and playing as part of that athletic conference. And we're very, very excited about the home opening game on September 14th against Rhode Island, and we certainly hope that you can avail yourself to be a part of that historic occasion. We're expecting a very big turnout, and we'll be having a lot of PR and publicity surrounding the opening of the stadium in the weeks ahead. So we're very, very excited about that. You probably have heard us talk about the acquisition of the Schuyler High School in the downtown campus. Is that acquisition is not final? And
close to final.
If I might chime in,
sure.
It's semi-final. In the real world, private world, we'd say it was final. The deed has been delivered to the university, and it's now in the AG's office, ready to be filed, pending the Office of the State Comptroller issuing the check for payment. Okay. So everything is really being held in escrow.
Checks in the mail.
All but the payment.
Well, we're very pleased with this because this is important space to our overall plan and ability to expand our presence in the downtown campus. We envision it to be a place where we will do some significant renovation in order to be able to offer more undergraduate degree programs there, hopefully move some of our collegiate units that are there now on that campus into better space as we kind of repurpose and refurbish some of the other space. The biggest issue now is where do we find the funds to renovate this major asset to the university. And I think it's going to be an asset to the community as well, because there's a 2,000-plus seat auditorium that I haven't seen, but those who have seen it says it's absolutely beautiful. And so we anticipate that that will become a major venue for a lot of university events, because we don't have a venue on the uptown, downtown, or east campus that would accommodate more than, what's the one?
Page.
Page is what, about 1,000? Yeah, maybe 1,200 if you use the balcony. But we don't have really large venues, and so this will be an important addition to our space. And I think an important opportunity to have events there that the community can be engaged with as well, and to allow community to use that space in ways that's congruent with our partnership with them. So we're very excited about this expansion. Of course, if you have that kind of space and using an auditorium with 2,000 seats, that means you've got to do something about parking. And so we'll be addressing that issue too as we move along. You'll be hearing more about that hopefully in the months ahead. The water tower and the main fountain are near completion. I think if you probably noticed, the scaffolding is down off the water towers for the first time in what, a couple of years now? Or it's been something around it for a long time, ever since I.
It's been up and down, depending on what stage it's in.
And so that they are putting the finishing touches on the fountain. I stood there and watched them for about 5 minutes today. That they seem to be working quite aggressively to get this done as soon as possible. And so we're very excited about this. And as you know, this is part of the lecture center and podium renovation that really is going to open that space up and really make it very, very beautiful for students and faculty and staff as they move about the podium and the lecture center in particular. They're putting in new glass a few weeks ago. They took out all the dying and dead pine trees, and we have new plant materials in those oversized planters. And so it's just a lot of change that's going on. So we know that there's a lot more work, deferred maintenance issues to deal with, but at least there's progress. And I can tell you that is critically important, and I think the students and faculty and staff are excited about what they see as improvements. I had someone to stop me today and comment on how the campus has changed over the last year or two and how excited they are for the fountain and the water tower to be completed so we can really see what this new thing is going to look like. And I think also they probably was hoping I'd bring back Fountain Day, but I'm not convinced of that yet. But anyway, we're very excited about it. We got a data center that will be opening in March of next year, which will allow us to repurpose our old data center located in the lecture center as well. That will become student service space, which I know Chris is quite excited about it and anxiously awaiting. So there's a lot going on, and our campus center expansion we hope will be completed in 2015. And this also involves an expansion and creation of much-needed space to expand the existing campus center, which was built to accommodate about 10,000 students. And as I said, we have nearly 18,000 students, so we clearly need to think about that. And finally, we have begun to design our $65 million ETEC facility. We'll begin the design work on that the 1st of October. We've been looking at different site scenarios, and hopefully we'll get the siting of the building completed in the next 30 days, and then we can start the necessary design work, and we hope to bring that project to completion in the 2017-2018 timeframe. On schedule and under budget is our motto. So, Startup New York, as you know, was enacted by the governor as a top priority, and you know the details, so I will spare you the details about this, but we're very excited about this opportunity because I think it's going to provide an opportunity for us to, in a much more seamless way, create these public-private partnerships with businesses to be co-located on university space that's going to advance opportunities for mutual combined research and development, provide opportunities for us to develop a closer relationship with the business community, create jobs, create in kind of incubator space new businesses and new business opportunity, and hopefully advance the intellectual property profile of this university. The rules are still being set and subject to change, I'm sure, but we've already entered into a couple of preliminary conversations with a couple of businesses that we think will be clearly part of our startup effort that's going to help expand our research agenda, and you'll be learning more about that now. We're very, very excited about the fact that some of these businesses actually sought us out. We didn't actually have to go begging and pleading. We see it as a strategic opportunity, and actually it's some pretty exciting things that's going to help not only expand the, our research portfolio, but hopefully will have spillover effect in changing and adding to some of the degree programs we might offer as well. So we're very excited about it. You know, after 44 years, Coach Bob has decided to retire. And so he has had a lot of longevity here. He's the longest tenured coach in all of college football, I understand. And he's had a career 264 victories, and he's number 14th on the college football all-time list. And if you have a chance to say hello or congratulate Coach Ford, please do so. He's been a very outstanding citizen of this university, and we're having a conversation with Lee McElroy now about how we're going to structure the search for his replacement. And we're very, very clear that it will be a broad-based search committee that would represent constituents inside the university as well as key constituents outside the university without great transparency, because I think we absolutely owe that to ourselves and to the broader community that we recruit the best coach possible to replace Coach Ford. And so you're probably not going to hear a lot about this search. It's kind of hard to search for a new head coach in the middle of football season. So you won't be hearing much about that process rolling out until the season starts to wind down. But we're very, very excited about the opportunity to search for an outstanding coach to replace Coach Ford. So we're very, very pleased with that. We have named our 2013 Citizen Laureate and Academic Laureates. They will be the Holocaust Scholar and a Union College Professor. Stephen Burke is one of the individuals that have been named. And the other individual is someone that we all know as the Community Laureate. We go into Albany Med Center President and CEO Jim Barbaugh. Not Burr. He doesn't cut hair. Okay. I think you all are familiar with the Citizen Laureate Award. It's probably one of the biggest events that this university sponsors each and every year. Had an update from Fardeen today. We seem to be on target with the participation level with this event. And as you know, this is a big fundraising opportunity as well. And so we are very, very excited about that. That is scheduled for October 24th at CEFQ Arena, which is our second year of hosting the venue there. And after having had the opportunity to drive to Saratoga a couple of times now, I think CEFQ is best. It's definitely a good venue for that. It was very beautiful last year, and we expect it to be a very excellent turnout.
Overall, excellent move to come on campus for the event.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I think everybody is, don't get me wrong, Saratoga is beautiful, but it was a very nice venue. And just in closing, I'd just like to again remind all of you of the inaugural week activities that we are framing around the tagline of celebrate in advance, and I'd like to add to that, celebrate in advance the excellence of the University of Albany. This is a week-long celebration that starts on September 21st and runs through the 28th. There are a number of events that are planned, thought-provoking seminars, performances, compelling discussions, and just general opportunity to celebrate where we've been and to articulate the vision for the university going forward. It will involve discussions and performances. We will have Carol Lee Carmelo from the class of 1982, who's a Broadway star, joining us. My very good friend Naomi Tutu and one or both of her sisters from Johannesburg will be joining us for a discussion of international issues, social issues. And Pulitzer Prize winner Gilbert King will be with us, as well as the architects of Barack Obama's second successful presidential campaign will be here as well as a part of the World Within Reach speaker series that our students put on each and every year. This will culminate in my installation as president, 19th president, on September 28th, 2013. I'm very excited about, I feel like I'll be legitimate on that day, so very excited to get that done. And we hope that you all can avail yourself to be part of these festivities. So I'm very, very excited about where the university is now. There are a number of challenges we face. But overall, I think that there are some very, very exciting opportunities ahead of us this next academic year and beyond. And so with that, Mr. Chair, that ends my report.
Questions from the President?
Yeah, this is Mike Stein. I had two questions. Will someone send us information on how to get tickets to both the football game, because I've never done that before. In the old days, you just used to have to show up. And also to the lecture series.
Yeah, we'll take care of that for you, Mike. We'll make sure all the council members have that information.
Thanks, Mike.
Anything else? Okay, then let's move to the next item on the agenda, the revised code of conduct. To get this on the table, could someone make a motion to approve the revised code of conduct?
So moved. Mike Stein.
Second?
Second.
Pierre? Okay. Before we begin the discussion, I do want to thank council members Mike Stein, Abner, and Gary for their work with Chris in putting this together. Anytime you do something like this, it is it sounds good when the subcommittee comes together, but when you have to roll up your sleeves and do it, it's an awful lot of work. So I want to thank that group. And then open it up for presentation and discussion.
Okay. Let me just add that you know, when Pierre made this suggestion to look at the entire code of conduct back in the spring, it was really, I think, well-timed. We had wanted to redo the code of conduct and streamline things, eliminate redundancies, and make it much clearer for our students. And Mike and Abner and Gary all worked alongside of me and the Office of Conflict Resolution and our counsel's office, John and Janet, to really look at every word in the code and come up with what I think is a great revision that makes a lot more sense and will be much clearer for our students to understand and follow as a code of conduct as their responsibilities on this campus. It basically took us the entire summer to do it, and we finished it just in time for to send out the entire code for the group to look at before this meeting. And Mike has agreed to represent the group to maybe say a little bit more about the process we went through and maybe open the floor for discussion on it. Mike, do you want to say a few words?
Yes, sure. I think what we did in a series of phone, Chris would send us the material in advance. We would review it, and then we had a series of phone conference calls, and I can't honestly remember how many. It was three or four, I think. And all of us had marked up changes and had recommendations, much of which became somewhat a bit of wordsmithing, but in an attempt, as Chris said, to eliminate redundancy and really enhance the clarity of the document. And it's difficult because, to a certain extent, much of this language is dictated by rules and regulations and legal rulings that you really can't be too creative with. I think one of the things that was important, and Chris, help me here, because I don't know if this existed before, I'm forgetting now, but the whole section, which I found interesting, is the whole Appendix L, the double, definition of double jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Was that there before, Chris? I can't remember.
No, that was a new appendix added to the code. And that was purposely added because over the last year, we've done a lot more with our code of conduct for off-campus students. We've always been able to apply our code to off-campus, but because we've had so many issues with our students in the city regarding the quality of life down there and how they may be affecting the neighborhoods. We created a partnership with the city to really work more closely with them in addressing these issues with our students, and I think we've been pretty successful in that. But one of the issues...
So you can be tried for the same crime twice if you're a student, in the sense that, you know, there is a, you know, there are the regular court system, and then there is the university, the student conduct system, and they could reach conceivably different verdicts. And I found that part interesting but important. I say this as someone who many, many, many moons ago worked in the student conduct arena at UAlbany as a dorm director, so... I thought that was particularly helpful because I actually do remember issues arising even back in those days. Other issues that we dealt with, as you saw if you reviewed the material, the academic integrity, and that really was primarily driven by the Faculty Senate's deliberations on that matter, as it should be. And then finally, one change that I think was significant is that in order to appeal a ruling right now, a student must actually file their own appeal. In the past, they could have someone file that on their behalf. And I think, Chris, you could probably explain better than I the reasons why we made that change.
Yes, I think that what's happened is we expect the student conduct system to, you know, be an onus on the student to really, you know, take care of these issues themselves. And in many cases, what students were doing is simply have a lawyer submit an appeal for them, which was written in legalese that nobody could really understand or make sense of. So we've basically changed it so that a student needs to submit their own appeal. And they can still have a lawyer advise them or help them in any way. That's, you know, that's not prohibited. But we are expecting that an appeal will come through signed by a student, not signed by a law firm.
But this is Robert Alexander. When you say, is it, you mean submitted and signed by the student, not by a lawyer, or
right?
I think I know what you're trying to get to, but the form, I'm just curious about.
Yeah, submitted and signed by the student, Bob, as opposed to submitted and signed by a lawyer with no indication that the student had any part in the process.
Right, so we're not abridging anyone's right to get outside help.
That's
or counsel
right.
To do that. It's just, you know, they can cut and paste in these days and just put their own name on it rather than counsel.
Exactly.
Great, thank you for that.
How different is this from
the previous? So I would say in summary... this was a somewhat laborious process, as was alluded to earlier. I mean, I think it's great for those of us in the council to get kudos, but in truth, it was really staff, Chris, and the legal staff, and others from various corners within the university who really drove the process. But I think what we ended up with, in truth, is an improvement. I think it is something that's clearer and more understandable. That's not to say that people will get it the first time, but I think we have improved the policies significantly, and I would hope that we would approve them at this point because we need to put them into action.
Mike, just
with that, I guess we would open it up to other questions. And Chris, I hope you're standing by because I'm not sure I can.
I am. No, Mike Castellana just asked a question about
I'm
how.
Sorry, I apologize.
How different this version is of the code than the previous code, and the code is not a lot different. There is one new prohibited conduct to our list of things that we prohibit students, and it's called endangerment, and that is the only new prohibited conduct. We did add an appendix on the double jurisdiction issue because students were questioning that. They couldn't understand why if something was dismissed in a court that they could still be held responsible on campus. And then, of course, the appeal process where an appeal needs to be submitted by the student themselves. Those are the three main major changes. The rest of the code was really a clarification for the most part of our processes.
Well, I feel good if I got two out of three in my little remarks. Sorry I missed endangerment, but that's what I was trying to do in my remarks, is highlight those things that had changed.
Yeah, good work, Mike.
The standard of preponderance of evidence was the same.
Yes.
The distribution of this used to be in the book, used to be handed when they walked in the door, and now it is online. Is there a way of telling if a particular student has actually gone through? Do they have to sign on and read through and then say, I agree and I verify and I've done this and I understand it?
They have to acknowledge that they received the code of conduct. They do not have to acknowledge that they read the whole thing. And even when we handed them the entire printed version, we never verified that they read the entire code of conduct. But they do have to verify online that they received it. And we also send out, anytime we make any change to the code, we always send an email to every student to make sure that they understand that there have been some changes to the code and we outline what the changes are.
I know it's a nuance, but is it received or agreed to? So when they acknowledge, do they acknowledge that they, even if they haven't read it, do they acknowledge that they agree to the code of conduct? Or don't
no,
we ask
they
that
don't acknowledge that they agree to it.
Okay.
They just say that they've gotten it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a reason why we don't ask them to acknowledge that they agree to? I'm just thinking
that
about
that would probably be a harder thing to get them to do.
But does it say somewhere that by virtue of you accepting something or you living somewhere or you attending that you actually agree to it? Or
well, we basically try to outline to the student that this is the code of conduct that we hold them responsible for. And if they break this code of conduct by their behavior, then they are held responsible. So basically, we don't say to them, you have to sign that you agree with this. But you just have to acknowledge that you've received it and know about it.
Okay. I've got just a couple of questions of clarification. On page 6, the driving under the influence of alcohol, if someone is driving to Saratoga and they get a DWI, is that a violation of our code of conduct?
Yes. If it comes to our attention. And typically, something that happens outside of the jurisdiction of campus or the city of Albany would not come to our attention. But if it did, we would address it.
And is that, I guess I'm not taking exception to that, but is that the same standard that we hold everyone else to? Faculty, everybody gets held to that standard that if they get a DWI, it's a violation of a code of conduct?
No, this is only a student code of conduct.
Okay.
If I might, if an employee were to engage in an infraction off campus, we'd have to draw a nexus between the employee's duties, motor vehicle operator, bus driver in this case, and what they do for us. If it didn't relate to the work that they perform here, we wouldn't be able to pursue discipline.
Yeah, I mean, this is the staff's thing, so I'm, from a governance perspective, this is more my curiosity. I try to make analogies to my other lives, and to if Peter on his way home drinks too much and gets a DWI, I may give him a funny look, but I can't discipline him. We wouldn't discipline him for that if it wasn't in the conduct of his job, or in this case, in the conduct of being a student. But that was an observation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one I had a comment was on page 10, the retaliation under sexual misconduct. I don't know if we intentionally repeated this, but it's the retaliation section. There's a retaliation section earlier in the document. So
yeah.
I'm not sure if that was done by design.
It was done by design. The retaliation is a prohibited conduct, and so it is in the prohibited conduct section. Hearings in cases of sexual misconduct repeats retaliation because we're required by Title IX to lay it out this way.
Okay. Other questions or comments?
Chris, there's a question, recent case that we had an opportunity to talk about. Much of the code of conduct is enforced and enacted through the Office of Student Success and lands on your desk as the final arbiter, but some of it lands on mine as for the academic affairs side, for the academic dishonesty. And I'm wondering, in here, I I think I see two different hearing bodies, one for graduate students and one for undergraduates for academic dishonesty. And the for undergraduate academic dishonesty is the intent that that get resolved by Vice President for Student Success, or does that come over to me also?
That comes to you.
It does.
All cases of academic dishonesty and all cases involving graduate students are heard by the Committee on Student Conduct. And anything heard by the Committee on Student Conduct, when it is appealed, goes to the provost or the provost designee for final decision.
So that was actually an issue that we had tangled a little bit about before, because the student conduct appeals I wouldn't immediately know that they were that the
right.
Academic integrity.
And that's, I think, been laid out a little bit clearer in here. That was practice. That was always practice.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments, changes, recommendations?
I'll comment after a week if you want to approve it or whatever.
Seeing none, we'll move the question. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any opposed? Then that will be carried unanimously.
Under the umbrella of shared
doing that.
Yes, under the umbrella of shared services within the SUNY system, I know that the first time that we went through, or the first time that I got involved as a student code of conduct a number of years ago, Binghamton seemed to have the boilerplate that I think. Much of SUNY used, and all the work that was done on this, I'd like, you know, what's the thoughts on sharing this with other universities, other centers? We can share it through ACT, or we can just sit on our good work and say we got the best in town. What's the thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the Conflict Resolution Office belongs to a SUNY-wide group. And they are constantly sharing this information and talking about it. And so all of the codes and the SUNYs are available to other people. And sometimes important language is taken out of one and used in another. It's not unusual. However, every SUNY does have a code of conduct that's particular to their campus, based on their campus culture, et cetera. So I think, you know, ours would obviously be available. And I can mention that to our folks who actually are officers in the SUNY Judicial.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. John, you want to take us through naming rights?
Actually, Steve, if you want to just introduce the matter, and I can provide some background.
Yeah. John and I spoke just before this meeting. And as I think I mentioned in the email setting the meeting up, the Board of Trustees is now dealing with the notion of naming rights, and not philanthropic naming rights, but what should govern campuses when they're considering a commercial naming right opportunity. Meanwhile, General Counsel's office is working on a draft of a policy that will govern us. But understanding how close we were to perhaps naming the football venue and the athletic facilities, knowing we were downstream, they suggested that that it would behoove us to deal with this issue at the council level, so that we could give them information, a resolution that they could take up at their September meeting, because the next meeting after that won't be until November, and we may be well downstream in our negotiations then. And that could stall things out. And John, I won't steal your thunder, but it looked like, as a result of that conversation, it may make sense for us to think about all the venues we might want to name, identify those in our resolution, get it down to system admin, and then we'd have a permissive resolution and be able to name venues downstream without having to go back in onesies and twosies. It doesn't bind us. We can name anything for philanthropic purposes that we like, but this would give us permission to name venues that we decided to put on this list in a commercial way.
We're trying to be somewhat strategic, recognizing that the SUNY policy has not yet been adopted, but the timing issues that Steve described compel us to move forward. We have an understanding of what the broad outlines of the
proposed policy are going to look like. It's sort of a combination of the exercise of the board's authority with respect to the naming of university facilities, which necessarily includes prior approval by the university council, but also recognition that this is a commercial transaction in many instances that's going to be subject to the requirements of the state finance law, competitive bidding requirements, et cetera, et cetera. So rather than approving the particular naming up front, which would have been arrived at, and these are namings in the context of non-philanthropic, essentially these would be marketing agreements that include naming as part of the marketing relationship. So in recognition of the need for council and board action for naming of university facilities, but while also recognizing that this has to be undertaken through a competitive process, the outlines of the SUNY policy will merely require campuses to identify a list of those facilities that they want to consider to market for these purposes, get the approval of the council, get the approval of the Board of Trustees, and then go through the competitive process to arrive at a relationship that are deemed to be in the best interest of the individual campuses. Mm-hmm. Any questions in that regard? Steve, do you have the list of facilities?
Well, it never really came down to a list. I discussed it with Fardeen, and we suggested the obvious one is the football venue. The lacrosse field is already named. The track field might be able to be sponsored. The field hockey venue could potentially be named after someone. But be done in a commercial way, and potentially the gymnasium.
Would it make sense to just put that under the heading of all athletic facilities, as opposed to individual naming?
John, you think that's?
I think that would be satisfactory. I would suggest, however, that when we submit the resolution to the Board of Trustees, that we articulate specifically which facilities we're talking about, particularly in light of the fact that we already have a philanthropic naming associated with the lacrosse field.
Well, how's the performing arts? How's the theater at Schuyler? I mean, is there other marketing opportunities to not just athletic?
Potentially. In many instances, for non-athletic facilities, the demand is not quite so great. Oftentimes, there are advertising arrangements that are associated with these various venues. But I'm not aware of particular marketing arrangements that other campuses have for those types of facilities.
What about for the campus center? Even though there's not a shovel in the ground, there's definitely spaces in there that we want to have named or sponsored. That even though it's not started yet, would that come under this?
It's possible. Those kinds of facilities, again, the non-athletic facilities, typically the namings that are associated with those types of facilities will be the philanthropic naming,
and
in which there is a gift, and in recognition of the gift, the facility may be named for the individual. These marketing...
Or a business. The Sodexo Auditorium in exchange for a gift, but not for advertising purposes.
Well, it's not clear to me what... I'm sorry, Mr. Giannassi.
No. I think you're going to ask my question. Go ahead.
It's not clear to me what is the practice within the SUNY system or on campus for honorific naming of buildings, where that may or may not be any commitment from the person being honored, the building being named after them, that there may or may not be the same level of financial commitment to it. Because a lot of places, you know, there's, as you've already said, there, most of your athletic venues are probably your most lucrative opportunities for a naming right. But what about other buildings? As we rolled out buildings, and buildings have numbers here, and they are called hall, but, you know, what?
SUNY does have a policy for naming of its facilities associated with gifts to the university.
Okay.
And that policy is worked in conjunction with the campus-related foundations.
Okay.
Because typically the gifts are made to the campus and the university, and the campuses encourage the gifts to the foundation. So it's a coordination of the philanthropic efforts of the foundation recognizing that there's specific statutory authority vested in the councils and the Board of Trustees to name university facilities. Okay. And then they have, SUNY has promulgated policies and procedures for naming, and they do set target ranges of buildings will be at a certain level, wings of buildings might be at a different level, classrooms, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a comprehensive policy for those types of philanthropic names.
Does SUNY policy have something speak to, you know, we named 100 years ago, they named Houston Hall, Houston Hall after Houston. Mm-hmm. I don't imagine that there was a gift that was associated with it. It was an honorific naming. Is that addressed in SUNY policy now?
I don't recall specifically. I think there is a recognition that, let me step back. I believe there is a provision of the policy that does recognize circumstances in which a naming may be conferred for somebody who has made a significant contribution to the university through past service, et cetera. I believe there's a provision within that that limits or you have to get special approval to name it for a living person.
So if we wanted to call this the Zimfer University Hall, we'd have
I'm sure there would probably be an exception granted in that case.
So the distinction is the marketing.
That's correct.
It's the other things that go with the name.
Right. Right. And ordinarily, but for the authority that's vested in the council and the Board of Trustees to approve namings, these marketing agreements would just be a revenue contract between the university and another entity. It's the naming component that sort of subsumes it within that authority of the council and the Board of Trustees.
So we need a motion that identifies specific facilities. Do we have a thought on the form of that motion? I mean, is it something as simple as, you know, to identify all athletic and related facilities as detailed below to be eligible for commercial naming?
I think that would work. Sufficient.
And to Pierre's question, would we ever be interested in the performing arts venue?
Or campus center.
Or campus center.
So maybe athletics, recreational, student.
Performance and student venues.
Student events. Basically. I mean, I'm trying to think of a category that's big enough to fit around this.
Student life facilities, how's that?
Student life facilities. Student and campus life facilities.
And again, this is permissive.
Non-academic facilities, I mean, effectively.
I think what will have to be submitted to the Board of Trustees, at least under the current conception of the expected board policy, will be a list of specific facilities.
Yeah, we'll start with athletics, and we can add the others at another meeting. And
I think for our purposes right now, the impetus for us bringing this, I'd like to say strategically rather than prematurely to the council, is because of the impending desire to come to a marketing agreement with respect to the new athletic facility.
That's what drove it.
There will be opportunities, I think, for the council to consider facilities beyond the athletic facility at subsequent meetings where we won't be under the same kind of time pressure.
That's a great point, if I might. We'll have the policy as well by then, so we'll know. This will be shaped up with a lot more detail than we have right now.
So is it your recommendation that we limit this to athletics for now? Make it simple. Straightforward?
That's correct. That would be my recommendation.
Well, the September board meeting, this resolution should be adopted prior to that, or?
Yes.
Yes. Well, then we'll have to do it.
We'll have to do it in a couple of bites at the apple, but the first one, obviously, is the athletic facilities. So would someone be so kind as to make a motion to identify the athletic facilities as our initial detail of facilities that we wish to consider for marketing and naming opportunities.
I would make that motion to identify and approve.
Is there a second to that?
I'll second.
Is there any further discussion on this? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Please record me as an abstention, given that we already have our name on one building and have a failed proposal on another.
If I can just offer a point of clarification to the proposed policy under consideration within the administration of SUNY also indicates that this will apply to physical facilities under existing agreements for circumstances in which they may be rebid.
So, hearing that, John, should we include this FQ arena in this one as well? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you would include that, but you wouldn't include my thing because that's never up for rebid.
That's
right.
Right.
Right. That's
right.
Correct.
But you're right. If you have a five-year contract for the SEPQ, then unless it gets renewed, then it would be subject to a further renaming.
Correct.
Wouldn't that be tragic?
No, I didn't mean it that way.
I'm teasing.
Because I assume it's a fixed contract, right?
Oh, it is. It expires in 2 years.
There you go. Mine expires never.
You were smarter than I am.
I drafted it.
Is there anything else on this topic? If not, do we have any other business to come before the council?
I have one thing, Sue. It's an advanced copy of an invitation from Susan to the council members that will be going out via email, but I have hard copies as well. Inviting the council to the induction ceremony so that we can make arrangements with regalia, et cetera, as though we're commencement. So let me pass this around, and it'll be followed by an email as well to the council members that aren't here.
I'd like, if I may, I have probably an ACT report, if I will. I will start by apologizing that for the second year in a row, ACT conference is the same as homecoming. Sorry, next year we'll try to get into September as opposed to October. But I think you've all received, if you haven't received the agenda yet, the tentative agenda, it starts on October 18th. And we have Bill Howard, Secretary and Vice Chancellor, or Attorney, and Secretary to the Board of Trustees, and Stacy Hengsterman is our kickoff. We have a number of college presidents. Unfortunately, homecoming, I'm sorry that we have certainly Startup New York is going to be a presentation, as is Open SUNY, a number of topics that SUNY and council members are interested in. The Chancellor will be our speaker at the breakfast on Sunday at 8:30. In the event that you can squeeze in between homecoming, you would be welcome to that. You'll get the agendas coming out. And we do have a scholarship. Mike Stein also serves as a scholarship reader and reviewer, and we're talking next Tuesday. And voting, and we're very pleased that the University at Albany has a nominee in. Last year won it, Michael, or was that 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Politicking here, Pierre.
Oh no, I'm not. You abstain correctly.
We would hope you're appropriately biased in
So that's it. So that's the update on ACT. So, and again, you're more than welcome to come up for the Chancellor's remarks, the breakfast, or whatever. Just let us know. Accommodate.
Is there any other new business? Seeing none, a motion to adjourn?
So
Pierre?
All made.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
discussed.